hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, we are here this morning on Rules Petition 1804. I see that we have two presenters. Have you decided how you're going to divide up your time, or are you going to address different parts of the rule? What is it that you're planning to do? All right, very good. Are you prepared to proceed now? Please do.
Well, so meep, good morning.
Good morning.
This is the court. I brought these baby moccasins made by my sister to remind us what the meaning of the rule petition you have before you is truly about, the best interests of Indian children today. My name is Starlin Rose Turtelot. I'm an attorney for the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. I'm an enrolled member of the Little Shell Chippewa Tribe of Montana and a direct descendant of both Stockbridge Munsee and Menominee Nations. I'm the many times great-granddaughter of Menominee Tribal Chief Iyamata, who is a treaty signer known for his honesty, integrity, and keeping his word. I'm the many times great-granddaughter of Stockbridge Munsee Sachem or Chief John Kunkapat, who served as a selectman in George Washington's army during the American Revolution and who played a vital role in the negotiations with early missionaries, resulting in Stockbridge Munsee people embracing education and Christianity. And I'm the great-great-granddaughter of Lida Mae Kunkapat Gardner, who was sent on a train from Wisconsin to Pennsylvania to attend Carlisle Indian Boarding School in 1891 when she was just 11 years old, 1 year older than my son is now. I'm the granddaughter of Mert Veely and Roger Turtelot, who both served in Korean War for our great country. I'm sharing my family history with you so that you may see that I, like many other American Indian people, am here today because our ancestors have continually successfully survived the many and sometimes fickle policies our country has had towards American Indian people during the treaty eras, assimilationist eras, the boarding school eras, termination eras, and wars. When Indian people know their history, they can best advocate for themselves and for their community. Today, you have a unique opportunity before you to adopt a policy that will positively impact American Indian children and tribes. Adopting this policy, or the proposed rule, excuse me, will help to ensure that Indian children stay connected to their history and their culture, ensuring they know who they are and where they come from so they can best advocate for themselves and their communities as adults. This policy will assist non-resident tribal attorneys in gaining immediate access to appear in Wisconsin without the fear of violating rules of professional responsibility to advocate for the best interests of American Indian children on behalf of the great tribal nations that they represent. The current rule for pro hac vice requires these attorneys to file pro hac vice application, pay $250 for each case, and find and associate with local counsel, all while a clock is running in TPC, CHIPS, and JIPS cases involving Indian children. We can do better. We are doing better for non-resident military counsel. The proposed rule change before you would exempt ICWA, WICWA attorneys from the Pro Hoc Vice fees and from having to associate with local counsel, just like the military counsel exemption currently does. I humbly ask for your support of the proposed rule.
There is one other requirement for Pro Hoc Vice applicants, and that is to fill out a form that everyone has to fill out, and I'm sure that you're aware of that form. And it does require that the attorneys appearing in our court on behalf of anyone admitted pro hac vice are really subject to the supervision and discipline of this court. And there are a couple of other matters that are in that form, one being a part to which you object, which is the association with another attorney, because you're going to be here on a limited scope of issues, and also saying that you paid. If you didn't have to acknowledge association with another licensed attorney or to pay the fees, would you have any objection to the courts continuing to require completion of the form by an attorney appearing on one of these matters for the tribe?
Thank you for your question, Justice Rogensack. There was some confusion on our part about Appendix A, which is what the rule calls it, and then an application, which is another name for it. And some of the confusion comes from, I think, how it's being implemented. On the Wisconsin court system, question number 6, are there any exceptions to filing of the application for admission pro hac vice? And the answer is yes. Non-resident military counsel are exempt from both the application and fee requirement. On that note, that's why we included that language to not have to file an application. Okay. However, we're not opposed to doing whatever we're currently doing for a non-resident military counsel. We would take the position that we, our non-resident ICWA WICWA attorneys should be treated the same.
Okay, so you would be okay. That's a fair answer to the question. Thank you.
Would the similar treatment extend to the trial court being able to exercise discretion on whether the individual would be admitted pro hac vice? So under current 10.03 sub 4 sub C, with regard to the treatment of military counsel, a rule says a court in this state may allow a non-resident military counsel to appear. In the application, in the petition, the proposed change was the court shall admit.
You are correct. We did put the language shall, and that was based off the ideology that the federal ICWA is a requirement, and so these notices and appearances of tribes are federally preempted. They need to happen. So we put shall in there. That is a subtle difference.
Would you object if it was made consistent with sub 4 sub C, so that it is met? And the reason I ask is because the discretion, I think, to admit an attorney is an important one, right? Because we don't necessarily admit anyone, even someone who goes through the application process, filling out the form and associating with Wisconsin counsel and paying the fee, the court still retains the discretion to say no. And that might be because of the character of the individual attorney who's seeking admission. We might just say, we're not going to allow you to practice in Wisconsin courts. And that discretion is retained with respect to non-resident military counsel. And I'm wondering if you would object to us retaining that discretion when it comes to non-resident tribal counsel.
I think there are really good reasons why we put shall, but I do not object. Other questions before I turn it over to my colleague, Danica Zavea. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
So may it please the court, my name is Danica Zavea. I'm an attorney for the Menominee Indian Tribe. I have been for about the past 9 years. I call my colleague the passionate colleague. She's giving you sort of the heart of the matter here. And so what I'm going to talk to you about are two things, really, is sort of comparing the different language that we use from the first comment from Petition 1709 to the current language that we have before you. And it'll, I think, address questions both by Chief Justice and Justice Kelly. And then just sort of give you an update to the numbers that we received from the Department of Children and Family of Out-of-Home Children to give you sort of a 5-year look at maybe what that fiscal impact might be. And then just a little personal why I got pulled into this petition. So I'll start with that. We had lost our ICWA attorney, and then I stepped in, our ICWA child support attorney with the tribe. And so I had stepped in to handle all of the ICWA caseload, and STAR stepped in to handle the child support. So after putting on 10,000 miles on my car in the state of Wisconsin and then appearing in five different states, I sat in on a case in Oklahoma where it was probably about 2 years we had already sat in. The previous attorney had been admitted by the bench, didn't go through the Oklahoma Association and fee process, but we had requested through motions through the bench, and I had continued to do that. And there wasn't a problem. Our motion to intervene was accepted. Any of our other appearances were accepted. But when we found out there were criminal history backgrounds that were withheld from us as far as the placement of where our children were, we were wanting to motion the court for a change of placement and requesting information. The moment we did that, it was like, wait, I don't know if you can motion. You might not be able to if you don't associate with counsel. And so it started this process. It ended up, you know, finishing on completely different other matters, but that's how we sort of got into the, at least how I think I got brought into this petition. So that was really sort of where that history for us came in, because we recognize that we're here and we're admitted into the state bar of Wisconsin. So that was really how I was brought in. If you look at the different language that we submitted, the second language is significantly different. It requires a bit more information as far as what we're bringing to the court.
Can you tell us what the second language is? Stuff dating way back.
Yes. So the first comment that we had was the shall comment, and it mirrored, it created in the subsection 4C. We basically kept the exception and did the may was military, shall was ICWA, but the same language was there. The second, this petition before you, 1804, it's patterned off of the most recent cases in, or recent rule changes in Michigan, Oregon, and Washington, where basically the shall and it is sort of removed. But if you look at the G, the proposed language, that non-resident counsel is not required to associate with an active member of the state bar and is not subject to any application or fees for admission, pro hoc vitae admission, if they establish to the satisfaction of the court. So that is where the shall was taken out, and then the satisfaction of the court, 1, 2, and 3, are relating to the intervention rights under federal ICWA. So if you look, that's basically, it's for the limited purpose for the child custody proceedings where the tribes have that right to intervene. 2 is that they're representing an Indian tribe, and then 3 is that they're affirming that the child is an Indian, meaning that intervention as far as the child, you know, either being an Indian or eligible for membership. And so the reason we sort of changed our language, that was we sort of looked at the comments that we had received from the previous petition as well as the sort of the comments from your order when you denied 1709, talking with some other in-house tribal council, and then looking at what were the current states that had done that and that were more similarly situated to Wisconsin. And so Oregon and Washington had, and Michigan had pretty much, they're very similar. They give you a subsection rules that you have to prove to the court, whether in person or by affidavit, basically these federal intervention rights. And when you do that, they have shall in their language. You shall be admitted. So we were following that model, and it's a model that is put out by Catherine Fort from their Indian law when they represent a lot of tribes in their legal clinic that they do. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of went that route because we weren't sure, you know, as far as with that first petition being denied, and we did recognize the difference between may and shall, and one of the comments we received from another in-house tribal council was, well, maybe separate from military and create its own subsection so that you are relating it directly to that, you know, federal preemption analysis, the best interest of Indian children, and then you're proving to the court when you're motioning. Now, going back to the application, while we did leave it in here that you're not required to do that, and we did that because of the confusion between the OLR's website sort of questions and then the Supreme Court rule 10.034C, which, or 10.03, it requires the application. So there is a model that we didn't quite copy Washington's, and Washington has an additional subsection that we didn't include, and if we wouldn't object to including, that allows the attorney motioning before the court, improving all of these other subsection parts, to within 7 days submit a cover sheet to, which is basically their application. And then that cover sheet gives instructions that they only have to complete sections 1 and 3, which is giving their name, their bar number, their good standing, and then have them check an exemption box, and then give the name of the case. I'm assuming it's for tracking data, too, so they can tell how many admissions are they giving for ICWA cases, which is hard to do, which is hard to find here. So that was something that I don't think we quite explained in that supplemental memo correctly, because we had a little bit of confusion. But I wouldn't object to having that cover sheet and that information being provided. The shall is a sort of implied shall in this new language, and it's basically if you prove to the court to keep it discretionary. I don't know if that was the only thing that would, you know, stop it from getting in. We would support it because we would, at a minimum, like to see that this option is before out-of-state ICWA counsel.
As I look at the proposed language now, if I make sure I have this correct, so the current language that you're requesting is in the petitioner's response to the LRB comments.
The current language is actually in the independent petition that was requested of us, which is the 1804. It should be on the first page, that one page. Did we put it in the supplemental memo? We put it is in the actual petition.
Okay. All right.
So it's the one-page sort of petition, and then it spells out, it's a subsection G. So we're putting it at the end, which is what Michigan and Washington did. They put a subsection at the end of a similar, and Washington also had a military counsel exception.
Okay.
It was actually for spouses of military members. So it was a little bit different as far as where it's coming.
All right. So
go ahead. You want to finish?
Oh, thanks. I'm concerned that the language doesn't quite get you where you need to be. And the reason I say that is if you look at 10.03(4), there are three sections under that that provide for admission to the bar. Right? One is A, enrolled and active members. Right? B is your general pro hoc vice. C is military counsel. So in each one of those, there is a grant of authority to appear. So under your proposed sub G, there's no proposed grant of authority to appear. It simply dispenses with an application requirement, but there's no affirmative the court may or the court shall allow to appear language. So that's not matching up with A, B, and C.
Right, I understand that. And I think that probably was when we were looking at sort of how we were constructing it, I think we were trying to mimic it, but also create it as an exception, and almost like a hybrid pro hoc vice, because in essence we're asking you to accept it, but we're still following the pro hoc vice as opposed to a complete exception or waiver. And I think that's where that shall part got lost, and we were focused on trying to establish that intervention part.
Right. So would it make sense to borrow some language from sub C and put it in G? A court in this state may allow, and then go on from there.
Right. I think from a perspective of looking at making sure it complies with all the other ones, it would make sense to put in well.
So we could add that to sub G.
Right. For the authority
allow non-resident counsel to appear, and then non-resident counsel is not required to associate, and so on.
Correct.
How is it that attorneys are hired by a particular tribe? Obviously, you have to be skilled and understand the laws that you're going to be dealing with, which are quite particularized, but how does that occur? We have, about 11 tribes in Wisconsin?
Correct. There's 11 tribes, and that will actually lead me. I can give you the numbers that DCF gave me, then I can maybe explain how council would react to that.
Okay.
So we received from Tanya Cornelius, she's the tribal affairs specialist from DCF, that there were 112 in 2013 Native American children in out-of-home placement that are subject to WICWA. So I asked for those numbers because I knew the out-of-home placement and WICWA were triggering all of the out of, you know, non-resident council if their tribe would have them. So there were 112 in 2013. There are 105 in 2014. There's 129 in 2015, 116 in 2016, 119 in 2017, and 139 in 2018. Now, I was only able to get to 2018 in our supplemental memo. I received this just a couple weeks ago. So what I did was basically took an average of the change in out-of-home children to try and get some of an idea of how many cases this may have represented. So recognizing that children are grouped, could be grouped together, tribes don't always intervene, they don't always have attorneys for counsel, and they also could carry over into the year, so you're carrying over. So when the average there was about 13.4 of the change between the years. And then we got about a number from Kate Fort, who represents multiple tribes throughout the country, guessing how many out-of-court ICWA counsel might appear for these cases in Wisconsin. And she guessed about 20. So looking at that, from a 13.4, if you just say every one of those changes is represented by counsel and the tribe intervenes, then you're looking at about a $3,350 sort of fiscal impact. So $1,340 to LOR, $1,340 to the trust account, and then $670 to the Access to Justice Commission. And so if you look at the 20 numbers that was given by Kate Fort, go back and forth, is about $2,000 to OLR, $2,000 to the trust fund, and then $1,000 to the commission. And so we were trying to guess. There's no way for you to look and figure out how many ProHAC VJ emissions do you have for these current out-of-state council. And so I would, going back to your original question, Chief Justice, some tribes have an ICWA attorney or attorney, you know, either designated toward social services and ICWA, or they'll do delinquency and other protection matters. Some are, like ours, are combined with the child support. And so those are usually grant-funded, and so they're restricting on what you can do with that and what you can charge. And so that's how a lot of tribes will sort of organize it, because they're really all a grant position. So if there's no grant money, then there's usually not a position. Some tribes elect to have non-attorney representatives, and the BIA regulations just require tribal representation. And that's ironically where that first federal preemption argument started back in Nebraska and Oregon, claiming no groups have to be represented by attorneys. You can't have non-attorneys representing you. And so that preemption argument is what followed through then on the ProHAC VJ analysis. So, and I couldn't give you a guess at how many of the 569 tribes, you know, have, you know, designated ICWA council, have the means to do that, or even have a social services department, and or have a structure to handle that. And then some choose not to intervene because it is a full, basically budgeted position when you're talking about intervening when you get notice of your children. So we were trying to guess and give you numbers of what that fiscal impact would be, and then describe it runs the gamut between tribes and how they kind of structure their government. So I couldn't really even give you a guess, but the ones that usually do have counsel are usually through the grant applications, or that they have the financial ability to have as many attorneys as they need.
Okay, so the tribes, though, always choose a person licensed to practice law to appear on behalf of the tribe in these ICWA matters, correct?
That is correct. Okay. Some tribes will designate their social services director as their ICWA, person, or also their giving expert testimony, and they'll sort of combine those roles. They'll have a designated ICWA specialist that they can do, and they'll appear. I mean, that has other issues with trying to practice before the court, but they don't always have counsel. And I don't know if tribes would hire outside counsel. If they contract counsel, they might, or they might utilize services like Kate Fort and her legal clinic for those who can't. And so then she would do that for the other tribes.
Okay. Thank you.
It's my best guess.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
There's one person who has signed up to speak in addition, Nicole Homer.
May it please the court. Seguli. Nyongets Nicole Homer. Hello, my name is Nicole Homer. I'm a citizen or enrolled member of the Oneida of the Thames First Nation in Canada. However, I grew up just off the Onondaga Reservation in New York. I currently work with the Ho-Chunk Nation. I recently just switched roles, though, so I'm not actually doing these cases. But prior to my recent move from the executive branch to the legislative branch, I had spent 10 years doing these matters. So I have quite a bit of experience doing these cases and attempting to intervene in other states. So I kind of have an idea of, you know, what these other tribes are up against when it comes to trying to appear in an out-of-state matter. I would just even back up to the point that under the federal law, you are not required, a tribe is not required to have an attorney to intervene in a matter. So you could very well have an ICWA specialist as the only party representing the tribe. And they have just as much rights under the federal law to submit reports and speak within the hearings. And so if we're looking at the public policy reason for what Pro Hoc Vice is all about, I would say that some sort of rule that we're, such as the ones that we're proposing today, probably protects those public policy concerns and remedies those much better than the current system. So this would allow more tribes to actually hopefully have attorneys representing them in these matters instead of just having an ICWA specialist who is not knowledgeable completely about child welfare laws in different states. Yes, they might be knowledgeable about the Indian Child Welfare Act generally, but just the different processes. And it varies, although we have obviously these federal overarching laws, such as the ASFA, American Safe Families Act, that has certain things that every state you're going to see that's required for their federal funding. The reality is the states still vary from case to case. So it is in the tribe's benefit, it's in the public policy benefit to actually have an attorney represent the tribe when possible. There are 573 federally recognized tribes, actually, now. There was a bill recently within the last few years that President Trump signed that added on the Virginia tribes. So we are now at 573 federally recognized tribes that could potentially have a child in Wisconsin that would be subject to the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act and the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act.
Is it possible to have a child that two different tribes would be intervening to participate in a decision about that child?
It is possible in a sense. Initially, if a child is eligible for both tribes, then both tribes typically will submit their notice right away. Yes, this child is eligible. We're seeking to intervene. However, the new federal regulations do kind of lay out a better process as to how to figure out which tribe will be the main intervening tribe. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the tribes aren't still communicating to ensure that everyone's interests in this child are being protected. But usually if it's a member of a tribe, then it's just that tribe that would be intervening. But there is a chance that you could have multiple tribes involved. I had a case where I believe there were two other tribes that the child could be eligible for.
Mm-hmm.
And Ho-Chunk is, you know, I'm very lucky to work at Ho-Chunk because they are in a position where they have the ability and the funds to be more proactive in these cases. But some of the, in the case that I, example that I just stated, those other two tribes actually were poorer tribes. So they were actually looking to us to intervene because we had, you know, the capacity, and they did not. Mm-hmm. So I just believe that, you know, some sort of rule is definitely needed. I do likewise concede with my colleagues here that there are maybe obviously different language that could potentially be added requiring an application, having that extra step such as Michigan that has that 7-day requirement to file essentially an application with varying information. So I believe that we are willing to work with the court and assisting in whatever way that we can to find some language that will obviously protect that public policy interest as well as protect our Indian children that are so near and dear to us. They're our future. Our numbers obviously are dwindling. We're not a large segment of the United States population. So these are going to be our future leaders, and they're the ones that are going to be carrying our tribes, our culture, our government forward. And so there is a, you know, a dual aspect of what federal ICWA looks to protect, and it's not just the Indian children and keeping their connection with the tribes, but it's also to protect the tribal governments themselves to ensure that we have our future leaders so that we are continuing into the future. You know, we're here today because we have to think about the seventh generation. Whatever we do here today, we have to look seven generations out to try and find a way to make sure that those children are going to be protected as well. Again, I definitely think that there are concessions that could be made, whether it's a may or shall. I think that I personally think that, obviously I prefer shall because the federal law requires and allows for tribal intervention. But I think may also will still hopefully get us to our end goal of making sure that we have actual attorneys that are representing these tribes so that the best interests of the tribe are represented. Anecdotally, I had a case in Georgia that was an absolute, probably the most difficult case that I had just getting to the courtroom door. We were pretty much told that we were not allowed to do anything. We were not allowed, initially they told us we could not even call in. Mind you, the federal regulations now state that courts need to provide some way for out-of-state tribes to be able to participate, or even in-state that are far away and just can't get there. So hopefully that federal regulation will assist in that, but initially we were told we couldn't even call in. And then we were told we can call in, but we were not allowed to speak. And that the only way that we would be allowed to speak is if we followed each and every one of the rules and physically showed up in Cobb County, Georgia, which is quite a long ways away. I very luckily went to law school in the South. I went to law school in Louisiana, and my roommate happened to be a Georgia-licensed attorney. So I reached out to her. She'd never really stepped foot in a courtroom before because she did a lot more transactional work. And I told her, it's fine. I will work with you to teach you the law, provide you all of the resources that you need to get up to speed on what ICWA is all about. And thankfully, we were able to have somebody represent us in that matter, and that child is continuing to be a part of the Ho-Chunk Nation. But I can only imagine if I did not have that rare opportunity of having this roommate that just happened to be licensed there. It would have been extremely difficult for me to find somebody in Georgia Georgia does not have a federally recognized tribe, so there's not many people that are knowledgeable about ICWA in the state, so it would have been extremely difficult to find anybody to provide us the level of knowledge and protection that we truly needed for both the Ho-Chunk Nation and this child. So it's just one anecdotal story. I have many. I have a Minnesota matter that was very akin to what my colleagues here discussed with regards to their interaction with Oklahoma. You know, we were involved for several, for longer than a year, and then out of nowhere, people were objecting to the fact that, to our Pro Hawk, which we had already been granted, and then set us back having to have all these additional hearings, which is not in the best interest of a child when you're looking to try to find either reunification or permanency within a reasonable period of time. So it just slowed that process down. So if we had a rule that was very clear from the get-go, hopefully we would prevent those unnecessary days that are added to these children being in out-of-home care without some idea of permanence. And I likewise would just direct the court to the numerous states that have obviously adopted some form of pro-hawk leniency rule for tribes. Nebraska was a little different. That was a state statute, actually, that said that they don't have to associate with counsel or pay the fee. But then obviously there's Oregon and Michigan, Washington, as stated. An update from my written materials is that California came in afterwards, so now we have California. And Minnesota is a great rule to look at as well. It likewise states, you know, you don't need to associate, you don't need to follow the normal pro-hoc rules, and you don't even need to pay and utilize the required online filing system, the e-filing system. So knowing that tribes from out of state would have difficulty at times navigating that. I worked in California for a little bit, and I can say there's 109 tribes in California. I worked up in the very northern tip in Eureka. I worked for California Indian Legal Services. And we represented these tiny little tribes that had very limited funds, that had to rely upon this nonprofit organization that was taking money in from various donors and the federal government. And so that was just for them in their own state. I can't even imagine what some of those tribes have to deal with when trying to intervene in a case that's outside of California, if they're having that much difficulty just trying to have an attorney represent them in their own state. So I do believe that some form of a pro hoc vice rule amendment is required to both protect the public interest as well as to protect the tribes. And then just as a last note, I'll state that the Ho-Chunk Nation is with you right now. My former boss, the Attorney General of the Ho-Chunk Nation, Amanda White Eagle, is here today. And she and one of my former colleagues, Noah Lentz, just filed a similar type of petition within our own tribal court to make sure that tribes, because we likewise have a pro hoc vice rule that requires a $50 fee for every single proceeding, which can be rather expensive when you think about how long sometimes these cases can go and how many hearings you may have. So we, as a sovereign nation, are right there with you looking at this, and hopefully we will likewise have a similar rule to protect our sister tribes across the country. Here, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you were the last person who signed up to speak, but there are other people in the room today. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on Rule Petition 1804? Okay, very good. Well, then that concludes our hearing on 1804. The court and our staff will meet in closed conference at 20 minutes past 10. We are adjourned.